Between client meetings, managing your business, and everyday tasks, who has time to worry about website hosting? With Kinsta's Managed WordPress hosting, you don't have to. They handle the technical stuff, delivering lightning-fast load times, enterprise-grade security, and 24/7, 365 human-only support. Simply switching to Kinsta can make your site up to 200% faster. Kinsta's custom dashboard makes managing sites easy, with powerful features designed to save you time and effort. Plus, their free expert-led migrations ensure a smooth transition. Ready to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses? Get your first month free at kinsta.com. That's KINSTA.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
First, there was Tuesday. Then, there was Taco Tuesday. Now at Wendy's, there's Takis Tuesday.
Get a new Takis Fuego meal, a.k.a. Takis Fuego Chicken Sandwich, Fuego Fries inspired by Takis, a bag of Takis Fuego Chips, a small drink, and also a small Frosty Classic. Yes, you can get that any day, but on Takis Tuesday, the Frosty is free. Make every Tuesday a Takis Tuesday. Gotta be Wendy's.
Limited time only. Participating U.S. Wendy's includes 1 ounce Takis Fuego Chips while supplies last. Takis and Fuego trademarks are used under license.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our episode today, where it is part two of my conversation with John Atack. Yet another opportunity to have a great conversation together. John Atack is a leading expert on authoritarian cult groups, as well as a best-selling author, and he's worked with hundreds of former members and has lectured and written extensively in a career spanning four decades. John wrote Scientology, The Cult of Greed, as a simple introduction to the subject, and his influential book, Let's Sell These People a Piece of Blue Sky, is the only comprehensive history of this bizarre group. Through his popular YouTube channel and podcast, he endeavors to make complex psychological ideas accessible. His scholarship has been supported by many academics from varying fields of study. John's book, Opening Our Minds, shows how cultic behaviors are established throughout society, and it sheds light on the methods used in pseudo-religions, therapy, and commercial cults. Even terrorism, gangs, grooming, hazing, and modern slavery. He also shows that these methods succeed because of failures in our educational systems. This is part two of our conversation from a few months back, and we plan on continuing these regular discussions about once every 2 months to see what John has been researching, as he always has something fascinating up his sleeve. If you are a member of our Patreon, you've already had the opportunity to view the full video version when it initially aired in April. If you're not a member yet, please consider helping us keep the show on the air by contributing as little as $5 a month to gain access to more than 60, yes, 60 bonus episodes, exclusive merchandise, and more. Thanks to all of our supporters for helping to make conversations like these possible. Here's John Atack now. I'm wondering, as we continue to talk, I mean, now moving into the idea of just leadership. I mean, here we're talking about leaders and their vision and how they, I just wonder, I get asked the question a lot, how they get people to do their bidding, how they get people also that we've seen as of late, even more so, to vote against their own interests. And to sign up for things that really are going to break down their ability to have rights. It's reminding me of, I was just looking at this because I was going to write a little something about it. It's a Turkish proverb that you've probably heard. I was going to say it's my favorite Turkish proverb, but that is saying a lot.
There's 173 that I know. Yeah,
right, exactly. My favorite of all the one that I know. The forest was shrinking, but the trees kept voting for the axe. For the axe was clever and convinced the trees that because his handle was made of wood, he was one of them.
Wow, that's absolutely brilliant. That may be my favorite proverb, let alone Turkish.
Isn't it fantastic?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I understand your plight. I am one of you and, you know, every man kind of thing. And no, I'm going to be tearing you down. But it is so interesting. And I'm thinking of that here, where there are a lot of people who vote for people in office because they can come across as, I'm here for you. I'm going to be championing your cause. And then they wind up being and doing quite the opposite. But it's the same thing, you know, with L. Ron Hubbard, with freedom, right? I'm going to be championing your cause to be able to be free, but I'm going to enslave you. And it's very disturbing notion that there are people out there who would be willing to make those kinds of promises. But how does one get to that point? Now, there are a lot of people who are having sort of, you know, buyer's remorse here, having voted, right, for someone who now is taking away the rights of their own children, their own reproductive rights, their rights of their immigrant families, etc. It's been an interesting time.
I heard about a guy who's in the construction business who voted for Donald Trump and J.D. Vance and is now already, and we're only a month in, is already regretting it because although his workforce are documented, they're Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
And they're terrified that ICE will come along and grab them. So, which was all predicted. This is the fascinating question. In 2014, Steve Hassan and I started working on what would become the Open Minds Foundation. And we approached Dick Kelly, who's still running the foundation. And I put it to him that there was one thing I wanted to explain to the world, just one. How is it that our reasoning is bypassed? That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I went off and wrote a book about it called Opening Our Minds, which was an attempt to look at just how wide-ranging these effects are throughout our society. When Michael Langoni, who was the head of the International Cultic Studies Association, read it, he said this is the first time that anybody has done a survey of all of the significant places where authoritarian control is used. Sad to say, ICSA never published a review of it. I've still had no explanation of that. I was promised it a number of times.
Yeah.
And you go, here we are. Here's a possible answer to this question. Why don't people want to share it?
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it started, you know, the simplest thing was when I left Scientology. My departure was, you know, I left because I thought Hubbard was gone. I left to keep Scientology working. I left to make it pure. And I found myself quite accidentally at the dead center of the UK independent Scientology movement. Now, about half the membership left. I was talking with hundreds of people who were upset and disorientated. And in the midst of all this and protecting the independent groups from the ravages of Scientology's harassment, which was, you know, I didn't know anything about that when I was inside because they didn't do it to me and they didn't ask me to do it to anybody else. I had no idea. And then we found out about Mary Sue Hubbard and 10 others going to prison in the United States, about the Canadian cases, the French case, here, there, and everywhere. You find out that there's been this intelligence organization functioning all the time. And that we've funded it. And here it is happening. So within a matter of weeks, I am given this pack of documents collected by this American journalist called Michael Lynn Shannon, which absolutely prove that L. Ron Hubbard was a liar. And I would later go on, I now have 23, I've added another one recently, 23 biographies of Hubbard, and everyone contradicts every other one. You know, words from his own mouth. So he was a liar. If somebody says, you know, I was 2 years old when I became a blood brother of the Blackfoot Wiconi people. No, I was 4 years old. No, I was 6 years old. Before we go any further and say they didn't have any blood brothers and that's in the public record, they've been asked and they never did. And he, when his aunt, Margaret Roberts, who was 8 years older than him and lived in the same house as him from the age of 6 months to the age of 12, when she was asked by Russell Miller, what about the Blackfoot Wiconi Indians? She said, I don't know what you're talking about. Who are they? So he made up these stories. I've got diaries from when he was a teenager that he rewrote. He improved on the stories in his own diaries, not for publication, just to, because that's what he did. So I got into all of this stuff about these contradictions, which are the proof that he was a liar. And this is a man who said honesty is sanity. It's a man who said the road to truth must be trod with true steps. And he was lying. What shocked me was that when I took that, because I just went, I don't want to do this anymore. I need to get out of this, get my head back, and then I'll look at it and see if there are any bits of it that I want to use. But I'm not going to audit people. I'm not going to do training routines. I'm not going to use the data series to evaluate situations. I'm not going to do any of it. I'm going to step back. When I put this to other people and say, look, here is a contradiction. So I remember with a woman called Vicky Ballard, who was a lovely person, and she'd been the commanding officer of St. Hill Foundation, you know, so she'd been important and had a sailor suit and all of that stuff and shouted at people. And I said to her, look, here he is in 1965, I think it is, in My Philosophy, which is handwritten and it's on display at St. Hill Manor. So it's authentic, saying that he was crippled and blinded the end of World War II, with physical, that's the word he uses, injuries to hip and back. They weren't pretend ones, they were physical. And injured optic nerves. So there he is in his own handwriting. Then go back, I think it's 1957. There's a professional auditor's bulletin called Communication and Isness. So he's saying, you know, I spent the last year of the war, I was in Oaknell Hospital, I was crippled and blinded. Injured optic nerves. There's this thing where he's saying, well, on the 25th of July, 1945, he even gives you the date, I was in Hollywood and I was feeling sorry for myself because I couldn't get an overseas posting and I was attacked by three petty officers and I beat them up. He talks about putting a bottle in one of them's faces. And again, so he was crippled and blinded at the end of World War II, which was the 15th of August. But on the 25th of July, he was fit enough to beat up, you know, blind, crippled, he was able to beat up these. This doesn't work for me. I told Vicky these things, and she would later change her mind and completely leave Scientology behind, bless her. But she just looked at me, straight face, and said, obviously he had two bodies.
Right. Sure. Yes.
We can trust the axe. It's got a wooden handle.
Yeah.
And so that is the great conundrum. Why don't we want to know these things? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you and I have both, we've spent decades trying to teach people that there is something really nasty going on and wondering why they don't want to know. I think part of the response to that, having, you know, I tried to find something in, you know, psychological texts that would give me an answer, and I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Not really. I mean, they have confirmation bias and cognitive dissonance and fundamental attribution errors and all sorts of good stuff that's very relevant. But this one thing, why is it that if I try and tell somebody something about what's screwing their head up, that they don't want to hear? And I think it's something to do with we have to believe in ourselves. If I start doubting my perception and interpretation of the world, then where will I be? I might come under your power.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that people will maintain all sorts of stupid and I think you've talked with, have you talked with John Hunter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think I just did a thing, just recorded a thing with Manufacturing Mania. Yeah.
Yeah. I have. Right. Exactly. So funny. I have a book.
Yeah.
Oh, upside down. But I read it upside down.
Yeah. All right. Let's stick mine upside down as well. At chapter 11.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's just the most straightforward hypothesis. You know, if you stress the hell out of people, mm-hmm. as they do in large group awareness trainings mm-hmm. and the military and religions and cults and all sorts of places, you stress the hell out of people, you get a buildup of dopamine in the brain, mm-hmm. anticipation mm-hmm. chemical. And then you release it. And they're going, oh, wow. And because John, as you know, is bipolar, when he was pushed onto a large group awareness training by his boss saying, yeah, everybody's got to do this, it's fantastic. He looked at the list of transformations that they said you would achieve. And he went, this is hypomania. This is the state that puts you on the edge of mania where you're going, oh, wow, isn't it fantastic? Oh, I love it. And so, and then he went away and did a PhD and came up with this brilliant, absolutely brilliant, mm-hmm. straightforward mm-hmm. hypothesis about how our reasoning is bypassed by getting us into an emotional state. And here he has this wonderful quotation from the remarkable Bertrand Russell, the English philosopher-mathematician. Mm-hmm. When the intensity of emotional conviction subsides, a man who is in the habit of reasoning will search for logical grounds in favor of the belief which he finds in himself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we get the experience, we have the feeling, and then we justify it. Just like mm-hmm. anybody who's been hypnotized. You know, mm-hmm. Ron Hubbard tells a story in Dianetics, Modern Science of Mental Health to explain how the reactive mind works, what used to be called the hypnotic mind, of course, at that time, that the hypnotist touches his tie and the guy takes his jacket off. And then he touches his tie again and he puts his jacket back on. And he says, but when the guy takes his jacket off, he'll say, it's warm in here.
Mm-hmm.
When he puts it back on. So there's a justification, what Sigmund Freud called an intellectualization. We are doing that all the time, sitting back from our own process of justification mm-hmm. and going, why did I really do that? Mm-hmm. That was a stupid thing to do. We get caught up and you have the obedience that's trained into us at school, where we're not taught anything at all about authoritarianism.
No.
We're not taught anything at all about hypnotism, despite the fact that we have hypnotic processes functioning all the time. It's how we learn our times table at school. Mm-hmm. You know, 7 times mm-hmm. 7 is 49. I'm never mm-hmm. going to forget that. What's called Chinese school.
Yeah.
Through repetition, you can get things into your head. That's good. If you don't know what the states of mind where you are vulnerable are when you're euphoric, when you're high, particularly. If you don't know what those states of mind are, then you're much more vulnerable, you're much more easily influenced. Most of all, if you believe you can't be influenced, you're entirely vulnerable, as mm-hmm. Margaret Singer used to point out.
Mm-hmm.
As a Scientologist, the easiest people to recruit were the people who knew it was all nonsense, who'd never be influenced by anything. You know, I could get them in about half an hour, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, this fundamental aspect of why are we unwilling?
And I often use the word yet when I talk about people who are unwilling, that they might be unwilling to look at something like the people who stay even after a loved one has left a particular cult, and that loved one feels desperate and depressed, feeling that their family will be there forever. And I will often say, listen, I don't want to give you false hope, but it could be that they're not ready yet. That sometimes it's an issue of timing. It's not yet feeling you can rely on yourself, not yet having the courage to jump into a world that's been so heavily demonized or just put down upon, you know, looked down upon, and now you're going to be one of these lowly people. And are you ready for that? So I think it does take a certain amount of a core belief that whatever you come across in this world outside, it has to be better than. It has to be better than the group. It has to feel better sometimes. And there have to be good people out there, even if you've been told that there aren't. Just a hopefulness, a courage that comes, I think, also with hopefulness. And not everyone has that. I think people fall into, you know, better the devil you know than the devil you don't, a lot of the time, even though what they say is, sounds so much more positive, that they're devoted to this and they really love it. But I think it is often better the devil you know than the devil you don't.
Yeah. And you and I have both had hundreds of situations where we talk with somebody who's been involved in some awful practice, some mm-hmm. terrible group, and, you know, they're still deeply involved. You know, mm-hmm. it could be that they've left because they felt they had to. It could be that they've been thrown out. Mm-hmm. But they still believe, and it's still going on. And being unable, it would seem, to understand what's happened. And as you pull on the thread, they'll start telling you what's wrong with the group.
Mm-hmm.
So with Scientology, they'll say, well, the sailor suits were always a bit of a problem, and the cost of it was always difficult. And the mm-hmm. fact that I was sat in a room for 13 hours without food being sold something was a bit difficult. And the walking up, and it will all come out. All of these things that have been lessened in value, these red mm-hmm. flags that have been put aside. So it's mm-hmm. not that people don't notice. It's that they undervalue the negative and overvalue the positive.
Mm.
So, and which leads to the point where everything the good that happens to you comes from the leader in the group, and everything bad mm-hmm. is your fault because you didn't do it properly,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't just belong to cults. The pain specialist, Patrick Wall, who co-developed the TENS machine, who was a doctor, and set up Britain's first two pain clinics, he said that if a doctor gives you a treatment for something and it doesn't work, they'll very often think it was your fault. And he invented the word hypochondrophobia for this. Doctors who think you're a hypochondriac because the treatment didn't work. And there's no way of persuading them. Mm-hmm. So it's not that we're ever particularly dealing with abnormal psychology or with abnormality in people. We're dealing with a lot of what we've been taught. So in my friend Ira Chaleth has for many years been teaching courageous followership, you know, how to assert yourself and make sure that your leaders, and I'm very happy to say, and it's going to be interesting this year to find out, I'm very happy to say that the US military are all trained in this. More than a million people have actually received courses in this, their civilian and the military component, over the last several years. When he came over to Britain the other year, he taught at Sandhurst, our West Point. And he said he thought there'd be like 30 people there, and they'd got the whole complement, everybody, and gave an award and all of this. So seeing that the military are willing to look at the concept of courageous followership, he then came up with intelligent disobedience.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of going, you know, he was giving a talk one day, and this woman said, I have an example of what you're talking about under the desk. And he went, yes. And she pulled out a guide dog that she was training and said, if this guide dog is with a blind person, it has to know how to be disobedient. It has to say, you're going to walk into something, I'm going to stop you. Why don't we teach our children intelligent disobedience? Kind of, because maybe we want them to be robots.
Yeah.
Maybe we are so capable. It's said that when chimpanzees learn something, they improvise. When human beings learn something, they mimic.
Mm.
Now, we ended up getting a lot more buns and houses than they got.
Right.
But nonetheless, we are compliant. We are domesticated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're trained. We're obedience trained. OT, those are the important letters there for Scientologists, obedience training levels.
Right.
The OT levels. And we also have natural groupthink. You know, my tribe, my culture is the right one. And the way we do things is the right way of doing things. You know, so, you know, if you grow up in Thailand, you'll never show the soles of your feet to anybody. If you grow up in an Arab country, you'll never wave your shoe at anybody. if you live in my country and you do that, that's very rude. But of course, it means I've still got my fingers. It doesn't mean what it is said to mean. It means I've still got my fingers. And it's what English archers showed to the French at the Battle of Agincourt. Because whenever the French caught an English longbowman, they cut those two fingers off. But it now means the same as that means in America.
What? Wow.
Things we do and don't do that are just part of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that if we see somebody else, I was in France, I remember doing that at somebody in France. They go, don't do that, don't do that. It's very rude. So it's peace, man.
It's, it's far out and it's cool.
It's far out and it's cool.
Yeah, right.
It's groovy.
It is super groovy. Super. Right. And so I wonder about that idea, moving into, you know, being conscientious objectors, teaching children to think things through. There are some, you know, Jewish tenets about ethical guidelines being the law that you follow, and which will mean sometimes that what you see is right is outside the law. Tikkun olam. Tikkun olam. Yeah, right. Repairing the world. Following your conscience, doing what you feel is right. And they were saying, you know, that the people who hid Anne Frank were breaking the law, and the people who searched her out to take her to a death camp were following the law. And
That's right. Jordan Peterson, never tell a lie.
Mm.
So when the Nazis come to your door, you say, I'm sorry, I've been hiding this Jewish girl from you. Yeah. Thank you, Jordan Peterson, for your rules for happy living. Oh, my God, what a simpleton. But still, that's another subject. Yeah, having conscience and having individual conscience, one of the things that we came to in the earlier part of our conversation is this compliance of, you know, the individual doesn't matter, the group matters. Now, that is a central tenet of the Nazis. Absolutely central that Hitler taught it repeatedly. Your life means nothing. It is the race, the nation that matters, even though the nation had only come into being in the 1870s, of course, for Germany. But then he was a foreigner, of course, he's from Austria. So the idea of separating ourselves from the conglomerate, the mass, the tribe, and saying, I can develop individuality, I can develop conscience, I can object. And I don't know if you've had as much trouble as I have, but in my life, I've not earned any money because when hundreds of people, you know, people came to me and needed help and didn't have any money, I helped them. Yeah. So I ended up I've scraped by. And there are a lot of people who kind of, look, John, you're not very bright, are you? You know, you should really by now have, you know, a big house and a yacht and all of these things. And not that I particularly want a yacht, I must say, just as well, really. I've got nowhere to park it. why didn't you pursue those things? You must be stupid. What is the purpose of life? Now, to me, very early on as a teenager, you know, I rejected the idea of God when I was 13. Just didn't seem right to me, because the God that was being presented to me seemed to be a monster. You know, and I wouldn't worship anyone that wanted to be worshipped. I'm sorry. That's just weird. So there I went. I have a different conception of that now, which is rather complicated. But I set about finding out what the truth was. I can remember at 14 going, I don't, you know, even if it's horrible, I want to know what the truth is. And it put me on a different path. It put me through, it put me into the study of Lao Tzu, which has stayed with me. I've translated the Tao Te Ching twice now, and I think I got closer the second time. First one was awful. I, you know, in the philosophy of Jiangsu, the other Taoist, I joined up with Zen Buddhism. I studied in a Soto Zen monastery when I was 18. I learned Zazen meditation. And had a year of doing that. Then I got into Scientology, all part of the same desire to understand how it works. And from there, leaving Scientology, it became trying to help people who are hurting. And you and I both developed tools and came to an understanding of how to help people who are hurting. Mm-hmm. And
it is
a matter of what is the focus. And for me, that meant that, yes, I have a conscience. Yes, I care about the evils of the world and the terrible things that happen to people. And no, I can't turn my back on it. And yes, that's because I was born an empath. And mm-hmm. yes, it's a disorder. It's not something I would wish on anybody, that feeling bad if you can't help people, because there are 8 billion people, let mm-hmm. alone all of the poor wounded scorpions and earwigs that need my help. You know, mm-hmm. that there is a hurting world out there, and you're never, ever going to satisfy that. So finding your conscience also, you have to, there was a Tibetan Buddhist monk at a meeting with various psychologists, one of those things. And he said, the problem with Christianity is that you think about compassion for others. We think about compassion for others and ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not a big fan of Tibetan Buddhism or Buddhism of any kind, I must say, but which is another and long conversation. But nonetheless, to develop individual conscience, to say, this is how I feel. This is what I believe.
Yeah.
And this is my reasoning. And I'm not going to get upset if you want to talk to me about my reasoning, because that's the point where you know that reasoning has broken down, where people mm-hmm. are like, you've got to bloody listen to them, you know, that kind of thing. You know, I have had a critical thinker shouting at me. Okay, really? No. So, yeah. And I mean, returning to the, we are so willing to give in to somebody because we think that they're more intelligent than we are. Mm-hmm. We think they know more about something we do. The mistake with politicians, they're generally either lawyers or people who don't know anything. They don't take any exams. They don't have a psychiatrist test to see if they're psychopaths. And I think that mm-hmm. might, it might be a good idea if somebody tested them, see if they're psychopaths.
Yeah.
And it seems that if you can't get a job doing anything else, you can get a job telling people what to do. And so we've created a society which has this wonderful concept of democracy, which I'm all mm-hmm. for. But as with Churchill, who said, you know, democracy's worst to the effect of democracy is a terrible system, but it's the best one we've found yet.
Mm-hmm.
One would like to make a democracy where people don't feel that they have to vote for the most attractive candidate or vote for, you know, there was one of the many Israeli elections, they seem to happen a few years ago, a woman was interviewed as she came out of the polling booth and asked who she'd voted for. And she said, I voted for Netanyahu or Likud or whatever. And then the person said, and why did you do that? And she said, well, my rabbi told me to. Kind of, oh no, I don't think you've really got the point of democracy.
Exactly. No, you know, right. I think that what's also interesting when we talk about leadership, we talk about compliance, we might not know whom to trust, who really is going to have our best interest in mind. And it's reminding me of a quote that's often attributed to Lao Tzu, but I think it's Sun Tzu. The evil enemy will burn his own nation to the ground to rule over the ashes. And I think when we feel that someone is really representing us enough where we want to vote for them, but we find out slowly but surely that they just wanted to have dominion. They just wanted to rule, and they didn't mind, and it didn't matter what they were going to burn down and destroy in the process, or even that it got burned down and destroyed because they could still rule over that. Then we know we're dealing with a very different kind of animal. And when that starts to sink in, I think people do get, they feel betrayed, but they can also feel frightened because they're no longer protected in a way that they thought they were. And so many of these rulers, I think, and leaders get to where they're going by working on people's fears, by saying, I hear you, I hear what you're scared of, and I'm going to protect you from those things, those people who are going to be taking away your jobs, et cetera. But here, suddenly, when people see that, you know, mom or dad or whoever is this sort of vision of our leadership wouldn't mind burning the house down just to rule over those ashes, where are we in this picture? Where is our safety? It's sort of nowhere. And I think that's what we're also seeing here in the United States. And I want to just remind people who are listening that this isn't a discussion about politics per se. This is about what we see in particular leaderships. I would be saying this if I saw this in a leader from the, you know, party that I align with, not even though I feel funny aligning with a party at all, but still one who is more aligned or a party that's more aligned with my kind of social value system. I would be saying the same things if I saw this, if I saw something that I think is dangerous. But I'm noticing there's a groundswell now of people trying to take matters into their own hands. You know, if you can't find out this information about what your rights are because this website has been taken down by the government, check this website. It's still doing what you need. Or go to these people instead who are still providing this or providing it for free. Just, you know, yes, they've lost their government funding, but they still care about this issue. And so I think there are a lot of people who have come forward because they still want to do what they feel is right. And mm-hmm. that's what you see a lot in these times, I think.
Yeah, and we're seeing a real groundswell of it. It's interesting because a friend of mine made a YouTube where just after Donald Trump was elected and said, now the resistance begins. Mm. We've got to be like the resistance in Germany. We've got to be like the resistance in Italy. And I'm going, you haven't really studied history, have you? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the White Rose in Germany, there were seven of them. We need to be, you know, even the Maquis, the supposed French resistance, these were not significant groups. So, and comparing everything to a wartime situation is not in the least bit helpful. It's interesting that in times of uncertainty, just the pretense of certainty is enough to attract people. So somebody who comes along and says, I know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so people go, oh, we'll follow him. And, you know, I say, I've read a lot about the Nazis over the decades. I've read a lot about the Nazis, but in the last few months, I've just read a ridiculous amount of material about the Nazis. And there's some really, really horribly shocking ideas. So you start telling people you're different and superior. So you're Americans, right? Mm-hmm. So you're American. You're the best people in the world, right? Aren't you? You know, you're fantastic. You're wonderful people. And I listen to every politician doing that. We Brits, we're the greatest people in the world. And every time, you know, it's when Tony Blair and New Labour in 1997 ran their political campaign. And I am, you know, generally incredibly skeptical of politicians, full stop. Yeah. I am not a Republican. I am not a Democrat. I don't favor any political platform. I am anti-communist, most certainly. I think socialism is a silly idea. But the idea that we're being told that there's a left and a right wing, when you look at American politics from a perspective of political theory, it's all right wing. There is, the Democrats are right center. They are not a socialist party. They're not. I was on a plane once and flying to Chicago, and there's this wonderful Armenian couple in their kind of 80s or what have you. And I could date it because it was the week that Clinton had not had sex with that woman. So it was being called Pinocchio and this kind of stuff. And they were, this guy said to me, you know, my wife and I have had 8 unnecessary surgeries because we have great medical insurance. And then he looked at me and he said, but at least we don't have your socialist medicine. It's like, I'd rather people didn't cut people off me, you know, let's just leave it there. And What about your socialist postal system? What about your socialist police force? What about your socialist army? Do you understand that the word socialist has nothing to do with politics? It largely comes, in fact, from the non-democratic Germans under Bismarck, who was mentioned earlier as appearing on the stage with the cream cheese apostle. Bismarck, socialism means caring for everybody, making sure that the poor are fed and housed. That's what it means. It was then adopted as a political system, and it became nationalist very rapidly. I was amazed when I was reading about the Chinese Exclusion Act, one of the great American things, 1882. It was decided that Chinese people couldn't immigrate to the United States because so many Chinese coolies had been brought in, and thousands of them had died building the railroads, particularly in California. They'd been blown up. They'd imported so many Chinese, they are terrified the Chinese were going to take over. So you got an actual act of Congress that excluded the Chinese, and which then led to the, and this really had ramifications, it led to the banning of opium. Didn't ban heroin, morphine, laudanum, codeine, any of the strong and worst forms, but they banned opium because the Chinese smoked opium. And that led to all of our modern drug laws, keeping the Chinese out of the United States of America, as you know.
Incredible.
So this, the sloganeering, the way of, you know, we're certain. So here we had Brexit. We had this stupid process where we left the European Union, made ourselves tremendously vulnerable economically and militarily, because we were told a heap of lies by politicians, and they didn't have to pay any, you know, Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, they got into power. And it was like, you know, we'd save, what was it, £300 million a week or something on our National Health Service, which of course didn't happen. But what they did have was a slogan, and the slogan was the most brilliant slogan I've ever heard. It was, take back control. And you just told everybody, take back control. We're going to take back control. And it goes somewhere deep in a human being going, oh yeah, if we leave the European Union, we'll have control again. And in fact, what we really have is the UK Reform Party, who used to be the UK Independence Party, with Elon Musk saying he's going to give them $100 million, which is five times what any of our political parties had as campaign funds for the last campaign. But he wants to get rid of the guy running it. I think he's palled up with him now, Nigel Farage, and replace him with Tommy Robinson. Tommy Robinson is a football hooligan with an arms full of convictions who Elon Musk wants to make Prime Minister of Britain. He's also, of course, been to Germany, to the AfD. Even Marine Le Pen, who runs the Nationalist Party in France, won't talk to the AfD because they're too far right. They're the first right-wing party to have any power in Germany since the Nazis. And you start getting this thing that's like this, it's a kind of fairy story. You're selling people this idea of a golden age in the past. Churchill did it during World War II, you know, this green and sceptred isle and all of this set in an emerald sea and all this stuff. And when was that, Winston? When was this time of perfection when everybody was happy and had a cream tea every Sunday? And you kind of go, in fact, in the 1930s, in the lead up to the war, the poverty was astonishing in this country.
Yeah, yeah.
Unbelievable. You can see it on film. There were, you know, people crammed into houses, not earning enough money to eat. There's a wonderful historian. He grew up in Lancashire here, but taught in Florida. And he wrote an autobiography. And he's talking about, of course, we always ate all of the last scraps of grease from the plate because we never got enough to eat. And in winter, we froze and all this. And you're going, so was that when America or Britain was great, when there was that kind of poverty? You know, was it during the Watts riots? Was it during, you know, and you paint this image, which is like the fairy stories we were told as children. And it resonates. It makes us feel warm and fuzzy that we're going to take back control. We're going to make America great again.
Right.
And we stop thinking. We start we start believing instead of thinking. We start submitting ourselves to leaders who, you know, how is it that billionaires are going to drain the swamp of billionairdom?
Right.
You know, I like to think of them as billy clubs, but that's my own little joke. They get together and beat us. And how do we, you see, I do believe absolutely and passionately when I wrote Opening Our Minds and when I helped to found the Open Minds Foundation, which is now focused, in fact, on critical thinking, which is a good thing to be focused on. But as I say, I started it with the idea of how is our reasoning being bypassed? How do you teach people to get that if they're emotional, they shouldn't be signing any contracts? You know, that anything that sounds as if it is too good to be is too good to be true. You know?
Yeah, it's true.
And how do we teach people to recognize predators, to recognize these beasts that walk among us and will, you know, smile at us and while they pick our pockets? How do we get that change? Because we appear to be living in a very simple-minded culture. Yet we have so many brilliant people. We have so many highly educated people. Though we are being told that as of 2000, IQ is going down in the Western world for the first time since IQ testing started. I'm not too worried because I've always thought that IQ tests were a complete nonsense anyway, but especially as I rate very highly on them indeed. So there's obviously something wrong with that, you know. I don't think it's I don't think there's any such thing as general intelligence. I think it's a silly idea. But how is it that, given the great weight of technology, science, medicine, and intelligence, that we are in such a mess, that we are so incapable of forming collaborative groups that make the world better, and yet we have. Wonderful things have been achieved. Fabulous things have been achieved by people working towards these goals. We are now watching them being taken apart. We're now watching, you know, Russia setting about recreating the empire. I got very interested in, what are the ideas behind Putin? And he's this wonderful guy, Alexander Dugin, and the concept of neo-traditionalism. And I kind of went, well, what are they trying to achieve, these guys? So I got one of Dugin's books. Thankfully, it was only 90 pages long. And I read it. And right near the end, I found out what they're trying to do, because he says it clearly. When was the golden age? Make Russia great again. When was it? What is it that Putin is looking for? Tsar Ivan. In the West, we call him Ivan the Terrible. The Russian word means awesome. Ivan the Awesome. They want a time when people had their proper place in society. You know, you knew if somebody was a serf. You know, you knew if they were a member of the aristocracy. They want blue blood to come back. They want the 15th century back again. And again, have these people actually ever read a history book? Do they know how awful life was for the majority of people at that time? That serfdom is in fact slavery. You know? Which was abolished in Russia shortly before Abraham Lincoln abolished it in the United States. What is this golden age? And the golden age exists in the imagination. And the imagination is the most interesting thing about human beings, because that's where we live. You know, I'm told I'm not clever enough to read Kant, having said, you know, how clever I am a few minutes ago. I'm not clever enough to read Kant. I've got to make head or tail of it. But I'm told that Immanuel Kant, the great philosopher, said, there is the real world outside, but we live, each of us, in our own interpretation of it. And all of the feelings we add. You know, so
it's interesting. I mean, there's very little that's objective, right? Most of it is the subjective experience. And I'm I know we're coming upon the end of our time talking this time, and then I know we'll talk again. This whole idea of certainty is this Achilles heel, I think, for so many. And I think that it all breaks down. I think of people, clients of mine who, and I talked about this in a bonus episode for my Patreon supporters. I offer them to freebie, or not so freebie, but they donate.
They pay, they get something free.
But two extra, as a gift to them, two extra episodes. And one was about the idea of psychic healing and mediums and the appeal of that, which I've talked about in the past, but I was really struck by, there's a commercial out now for a particular company that I probably shouldn't name, but it's where they hire these people to do psychic readings and you can call this number. And so their tagline is to experience the joy of certainty. And so I started doing some research into this line, and that the company, the PR firm that put together this campaign, used a team of behavioral scientists to put this together.
Not psychics.
And not psychics, right? And they produced this campaign, here I have it here, The Joy of Certainty, which aims to demonstrate how the business understands its customers and can help them navigate life's uncertainties. It has done very well for this company because of this. They also spout off a lot of statistics that 98% of the people who apply to be psychics for this company are not hired because they have such a standard, you know, that they'll only hire the top 2% of these people who can do the things that you don't know if they can do. But it's been very interesting to see how meaningful it's been for people to want to have certainty. And they also are very clever in their wording too. And I probably shouldn't say this out loud because then they might change it if they hear it, but that they will say that unless your reading is life-changing, you get your money back. But what does life-changing mean? It could be that it gave you something dismal to deal with. Or that, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean positive. It just means life changing. Did you have a new insight, or did it make you angry, or did it make you scared of something? Well, then that can constitute life changing. Then they don't have to give you your money back. But it is a very powerful tool. And I think I have a lot of clients who have gotten out of cults, have learned about coercion, have learned about manipulation, and then will say to me, you know, I have to hold back on how many sessions I have with you because I've started seeing a psychic, or I've started going to my healer. Oh, there's now this thing called quantum healing and quantum psychics, and you know, they'll just sort of add in whatever word is out there that
nice sciencey sounding word,
right? Yeah. That no one really on the street knows how to define. So now it just sounds super cool. But it's just
a packet of energy, quanta.
Quantum, right. But it's just the word salad that a lot of people use. Yeah. But it's a fascinating thing about what that we want to know. And we want to know what to expect. Mm. And that feels so calming, so secure. It's like having parents again who you feel are, if that was your relationship with your parents, who are letting you know everything's going to be okay. I don't know if most of us ever get rid of that or that need.
I think we can. Mm. I mean, I was very conscious, you know, my dad died in 1994. My mum died in 2011, and I had the great privilege of looking after her for the last 17 years of her life. And the last five were a bit grim. She was 94 when she died. But I did very much have that sense gradually, as I had to look after my mother, that I had to become my own parent. Mm-hmm. And this was an important psychological stage where you said, I am now the guru. I am now. It doesn't mean I'm not going to listen to anybody, but it means I'm not going to go to anybody to tell me what to do. And told that my grandfather, who sadly died before I was born, my mother's father, was often sought out for his advice. He was a carpenter by trade. But people trusted him, and he would explain to them that he was going to give them advice. He didn't care if they took it or not, and it was up to them. Mm-hmm. And that he thought they ought to think about it, and they ought to realize that if they took it, it was their decision, not his. Mm-hmm. There was a wonderful documentary in the 1980s about astrology. And in this documentary, 30 people were given a horoscope. 28 of them said, oh, that's so accurate. Two of them said, don't think so. So that's one person in 15 thought.
Wow.
Then it was pointed out to them they'd all been given the same horoscope. Then one wise acre, one wag in the experiment said, and whose horoscope was it? They said, well, we're glad you asked. He's a serial killer. And he, after he'd murdered his grandma, he beheaded her and he put the head on a hat box and played darts with her. So that's whose horoscope you said applies to you. And then they went to the astrologer and they pointed out that, she'd said, you're going to have a new job opportunity. And it was like, yeah, is he going to be like allowed into the prison library to take the books out?
Right.
I'm at the moment, it's just the way it is because I got very interested in occultism in Germany and the extent of it. And the Nazis are just a part of it. Mm-hmm. It was awash, cream cheese, apostle, all sorts of things were going on in Germany. Spiritualism, as it rose up from the 1850s, had a massive influence on the world. For the first time, you could talk to your dead relatives. Imagine. And so there are a lot of con artists who were going out doing this. The most famous of them, of course, is Madame Blavatsky, who was a spiritualist who then leaked the secrets of the Freemasons, the Rosicrucians, and the Sufis,
right.
And smoked a lot of cannabis. So, you know, she can't have been all bad. She was the first person to be investigated by the British Society for Psychical Research, founded in part by William James, the brilliant psychologist, and declared to be a fraud very early on, what she was doing. Her defenders, of course, will explain why this is nonsense, and she was absolutely wonderful. But because I'm trying to understand, you know, how influential were these ideas, this magical thinking,
right.
Because I think it is important. And I don't think that by becoming an atheist, you're going to have solved all the problems of the world. It's not about God or not God. It's about magic. It's about thinking that something supernatural is going on. Sadly, in the 90s, there was a survey of atheists, which showed that I think it was more than 80% of them, although they didn't believe in God, did believe in magic. Magic is the problem. So, okay. I've got this book called Religion and the Decline of Magic by an Oxford professor called Keith Thomas. And it is wonderful. It's one of the best things I've ever read. About 300 pages into it, about halfway into it. And it is a history of magical beliefs from 1500 to 1700 in England.
Wow.
And you find out that all of our monarchs had astrologers. All of them. The good queen, yes, Queen Elizabeth. And it was Charles II who was, I don't think there's any king that I'm keen on. I think dictators, tyrants, call them what you will, tend to be awful people. Queen Elizabeth, good queen, Bess, in fact, it's said that she spent, the court officials she spent the most time with in her very long reign was her chief torturer, discussing methods of torture, you know, and yet she is presented to us such a lovely woman.
Oh, my.
Charles II, however, gave us the way of checking astrologers. So anybody who's thinking of going to a psychic, do what Charles II did. Ask them who's going to win the horse races. And if they give you 10 good tips and you win enough money, then believe in them. If they don't, what is incredible in this is some of these astrologers, court astrologers, made huge amounts of money, and yet they were very frequently wrong. They were wrong about all sorts of things. And then you get into the justifications as why they were wrong. And let's try one here. I'm going to go with this. So you weren't able to predict the winner of the race because although you'd got the horoscopes of all the jockeys and the horoscopes of all the horses, you'd need those, you haven't got the horoscope of the blacksmiths who made the nails and the horseshoes. You haven't got the horoscopes of the grass on the pitch. And they did. They did horoscopes for towns. They did horoscopes for... And in the end, I started looking at it and going, oh my God, this is like therapy. That My opinion of psychotherapy is very straightforward. None of the systems of psychotherapy work. Some of them are reasonable guidelines. Mm-hmm. Some of them are completely insane. Uh-huh. Any kind of psychoanalysis, Freudian, Jungian, Adlerian, Reichian, Ferenczi, I might, you know, because of our friend Dan, I might give that a pass. But the idea that by the time you were 1.5, you wanted to have sex with the parent of the opposite sex,
yeah,
and you didn't know it, and you wanted to castrate your dad or do what, you know, electrocompression, all of this guff with no scientific proof. Nobody's ever found the id, the ego, or the superego.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
We have looked. Let's face it, we've looked.
Right.
Then, you know, even if you get into things like cognitive therapy or trauma-based cognitive behavioral, things that actually, you know, you are heaving towards something sensible,
mm-hmm,
what's going to matter is the person doing it.
Yeah.
And if somebody does not have a therapeutic personality, which is, say, if they don't care about other people,
mm-hmm,
if instead they're driven by narcissism, and I fear that many therapists are, then, you know, or they were desperate and they did this thing and it made them feel better, so they get other people to do it. You know, they've actually resolved, they've not actually become something like a whole human being and understood that they're packed with faults thereby.
Right.
And I think it's probably the same with astrologers, that mm-hmm, if they have the right kind of temperament, then when you sit down with them, they'll make you feel better and you'll go off and put the money on the horse and okay, it's going to lose.
Mm-hmm.
But you still feel good. You know, that's the main thing. You've still got that warm, fuzzy feeling, and you've made astrology great again.
Mm-hmm. I've made astrology great again. I love that. But I am make astrology great again. Right. I mean, feeling good, having someone make you smile, having someone make you feel hopeful. Just, you know, it's also the reason toxic positivity works, you know, it'll all work out. And just have faith, or, you know, trust me.
Just give me the money.
It rests.
I'll spend it wisely. You'll spend it foolishly.
Right.
I'll make the world a better place
by
buying pistachio ice cream for myself with it. Yeah.
Right. It's very interesting. It's always so interesting to speak with you. I can't wait for our next conversation. One more thing before you go. It, as you know, is always interesting to talk to John. And there are so many times where I see how what he shares with us is in a way to illuminate something that is so confusing that feels really difficult to understand. Not only when we're getting into learning about cults like Scientology, are we being introduced to a whole new vocabulary? But we're being introduced to a whole new way of thinking. And also, we're being introduced to something which is like Darvo on steroids. So, what is Darvo? Darvo is something that I speak more about in a bonus episode. And if you want to go to Patreon and be a supporter, you'll be able to hear more about Darvo and also get other bonus episodes there. But in brief, it is a technique that manipulators use to reverse things on you, to switch the causal relationship between things. It is when someone who is trying to get away with something will do what's called deny, attack, and then reverse victim and offender, Darvo. And so it is incredibly disorienting and frustrating. It's something that little kids do sometimes. And in fact, I remember there was a girl who I was working with who had trouble understanding how things went. Her mind actually, and part of the reason I was working with her was that her mind saw things sometimes in reverse. And she couldn't help it. This was not on purpose. What we're talking about with Darvo is very much on purpose. But I will always remember a conversation I had with her. She was about 7 or 8 at the time. And she came up to me with a boy, and the boy was crying. And I said, "What happened?" And she said, "I hit him." She was very open about it. She said, "I hit him." And I said, "Tell me why you hit him." And she said, "Because he was mad at me." And I thought, there's something wrong with this story. But I guess people might get upset if someone's mad at them. And he, through his tears, even looked confused by this telling of the story. And he shook his head and he said, No, that's not what happened. It's the other way. He just kept saying, "It's the other way." And I said, "What's the other way?" And he said, "I was just sitting there reading, and she came up and hit me. And then I got mad at her. She didn't hit me because I was mad at her." And he kind of looked at her for confirmation. And he said, "Right?" Because he was now confused about his own memory of how things went down. And she just sort of shrugged her shoulders and walked away. It didn't quite matter to her how things happened. But what was so interesting about that was that she was so sure in the way she talked about it that she hit him because he was mad at her, that it actually confused him for a moment. And it just happened less than a minute ago. And Darvo is actually something that can be compelling and confusing. And it happens rampantly in these kinds of groups and in relationships with manipulators. It is very important then to know what to do if what's happening in the group that you're in is that this causal relationship, what's caused what, is reversed. It's like so many people within these kinds of cult groups and within these relationships are made to be miserable, to feel miserable, to get sick because they haven't slept and they haven't eaten, they haven't taken care of themselves. But then they're told, "You are a miserable person," or "Your system is weak because you keep getting sick. So we're going to tell you what you can do about that. Here's more of the same. Here's more of what made you sick or weak or miserable to begin with." As though the story started with you being miserable. As though the story started with you having a lower ability to have a strong immune system. The causal relationship can be reversed and it can be confusing. And it's very important to stay clear about what started what. And what's also confusing within these groups and within these relationships is that your history is rewritten. So you might actually be convinced that you were a miserable person before. You might actually be convinced that your system was weak before you got involved. And so that's why it's very important to try to remember who you really were, how you really felt, what your kind of personality was like, what your emotions were like, what your physical abilities were like before you got involved. I think that's also part of the reason that cults and manipulative partners don't want you to talk to people who you used to have a relationship with, so they can't sort of help you remember who you are and what's true about you, and also how you might have changed now and what has caused that change in the negative. And so when you're dealing with this kind of reversal of a causal relationship, it's important to know who you're dealing with. And you shouldn't actually spend a lot of energy trying to win that argument, because they're wanting you to be convinced of something. So they're not going to be open to you saying, "Actually, I don't think so." What's more important in that moment is not for you to win that argument, but for you to be clear about it, for you to hold on to the truth of the situation. And what's also really important is for you to be able to consider the bigger picture. Where is this happening to me, and in what context? And is this something that is a belief of the group or of my partner? Has my partner done this to other people? Like the people who you might start to date, and then they tell you, "Yeah, all my other girlfriends were just crazy, or they just were such angry people, or they became so hostile. And you think, okay, well, that's interesting. Either you really know how to pick them, or you, the person now I'm dating, is the X in the equation. You're the one who's creating that happening, or you're the one who is deciding to just keep telling that story in the same way so that you don't have to take any responsibility. If it is confusing to know who you used to be and who you are now, and if you've changed in a way that is unsettling to you and worrisome to you, if it's the group or the relationship you're in that has caused it, please know that it's important then to get support outside the relationship, outside the group, so that you have a sense of what's real and who you are and how you're supposed to feel and what you're capable of and what your life is supposed to be like and what it can be like. Thank you again to John for all of his information, for the history lesson, for so much that's important for us to know about how things have started and where they started and who influenced whom and why things are the way they are now. Take good care. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
First, there was Tuesday. Then, there was Taco Tuesday. Now at Wendy's, there's Takis Tuesday. Get a new Takis Fuego meal, a.k.a. Takis Fuego chicken sandwich, Fuego fries inspired by Takis, a bag of Takis Fuego chips, a small drink, and also a small Frosty classic. Yes, you can get that any day, but on Takis Tuesday, the Frosty is free. Make every Tuesday a Takis Tuesday. Gotta be Wendy's.
Limited time only. Participating U.S. Wendy's includes 1 ounce Takis Fuego chips while supplies last. Takis and Fuego trademarks are used under license.